Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 19th of July 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Once again, it's the beginning of another week, another glorious week in Blighty. The sun is streaming through my window and I am here today once again with my co-host from Western Spring, Mr. Max Musson, to discuss the week's news and to get into our greatest Britons for the week. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? What's life like over your side of the country?
It's pretty good, actually. We've got some really sunny weather, which is outstandingly hot. Actually, it's almost continental weather that we've got here. I was out doing some window shopping yesterday, and it was rather like shopping in Rome or something like that. It was just so hot.
You just can't beat Britain in the summertime, can you? It's a beautiful place, and there's been lots of patriotism recently, although it's been misplaced, I think, with the Football Cup that went on last week, and everybody was expecting England to win because diversity is such a strength, and the government were telling us that 8/11 of the football team were of foreign heritage. And they said that this was going to be such a strength and the team were going to win. And they had such confidence in their black players that they put them all in for the penalty, despite the fact that they had white players who were more likely to actually win the penalties. I think the actual chance of winning the penalty was actually over half. They had a 60% chance of winning the penalty if you actually look at the numbers of people that win the penalties and lose the penalties. And it must have just all been a little bit too much for these black players because they fluffed up the penalties. And normally when somebody fluffs up a penalty like that, they expect to get lots of criticism. David Beckham, when he fluffed up the penalty, there were effigies of David Beckham being hanged that were sent to him. And I don't recall anybody being arrested for that. I don't recall there being a public outcry over that. And yet there was criticism of these black players. And I would say it's right that people should be making this criticism because the government were making a big deal of the fact that they were of foreign heritage. That was the whole point of them coming out with this diversity meme, diversity is a strength. They put out lots of advertising all about this, and you had the government saying, we're going to win because we have this diverse team. And then when the diversity actually fluffs it up, surely that says, well, perhaps diversity isn't such a strength, and perhaps you shouldn't have put those black players in that position where everything was riding on them and where everybody was expecting them to win. It seems rather to me like when they put Diane Abbott in place as the Shadow Home Secretary, knowing that the average IQ in Jamaica is something like 85, so her IQ right at the top of Jamaican or Caribbean heritage IQ is going to be about 100, which is going to be no match for white politicians who are going to have an IQ of about 130. And of course, Diane Abbott made lots of mistakes, mistakes in just about every interview, and people were mocking her and she became a laughing stock. And it was wrong of the Labour Party to put her in that position. And I think it was wrong of the football team to put those black players in that position. And when they did lose, of course, people are going to say, well, diversity is not such a strength, is it? But the real fact of the matter is, and this is really quite insidious, the news have been telling us that there's been all this outpouring of racism and all these horrible tweets, and the Marcus Rashford mural got vandalized with racist graffiti. And this was in the news for 3 days, and they covered up this so-called racist graffiti with flowers and messages of love for Marcus Rashford, and all the people that lived in Manchester all got there and they all got down on one knee and they had this vigil worshipping Marcus Rashford. And then it came out 3 days later, the Manchester police said, well, actually, this graffiti wasn't racist at all. So there wasn't any racist graffiti. And this outpouring of racist tweets, apparently 70% of those racist tweets came from abroad, with the majority coming from India. Five people have been arrested for sending out these tweets. So it really wasn't that many people that were actually doing that. And the reason for this is because everybody's been brainwashed into thinking that they've got to take a knee and they've got to worship these black players to show that Black Lives Matter and all the rest of it. So in actual fact, I don't think there's been an outpouring of racism. at all. I think there's been an outpouring of anti-racism. That's what it has seemed like to me. But there has been a concerted barrage of propaganda in the news telling everybody that they're racist and that whites are racist. And they're pretty much saying, if they're going to say that the graffiti that was on that mural is racist, they're basically saying any criticism of anybody black is racism. It has to be racism. You are not allowed to criticize anyone, any person of color, any footballer of color. You're just not allowed to criticize them because you will be accused of being racist. I mean, it's absolutely ridiculous. Are these people above criticism? Should we have people in society that are above criticism? I don't think we should. I mean, that's just setting us up for a two-tier society. And it's also setting people up for a fall, like these black players who never should have had all that weight on their shoulders. I mean, if they wanted to show that diversity was a strength, maybe they should have put one black player in, one white player in, or two white players and one black player to represent the ethnic makeup of the country. Then we may still have won the football then. But they didn't. They put all that weight on the shoulders of those black players, which I think was really wrong. It just shows that they're faith in diversity is completely false. And they've been attacking Marc Collette as well. I believe they're going to be putting out an attack piece on Sunday in the Daily Mirror. And their reason for attacking him is because they're saying that he said that the players weren't English. Well, they're not Englishmen, are they? I mean, the government itself was telling us that they have non-British heritage. They may be British citizens, but they don't actually have British ethnic heritage. And if they did have British ethnic heritage, then the government wouldn't have been able to come out with all this pro-diversity propaganda. So it's okay for the government to say that they're not of British heritage, but it's not okay for Mark to say that. It's hypocrisy all around, which I would hope is waking up the great British public to just what is going on here and how we are not just fast becoming a minority in our own country, but we're fast becoming second class citizens, and we're also not allowed to criticize the newcomers. What did you make of the football, Max? I don't watch football at all, but I'm assuming that you do.
Well, your assumption is partly right, partly wrong. I do watch some football. I'm not a football fanatic or anything of that sort. But I think what happened was that, I mean, first of all, let's just state quite clearly that racially abusing somebody isn't something that is pleasant, and it's not something that we support. That there's no need to use crude terms in racially abusing somebody. But on the other hand, we shouldn't necessarily ignore the fact that somebody is of a different ethnic or racial origin to ourselves, and assume that that different heritage is meaningless, because it isn't meaningless. It does have meaning, and what we saw was with the European Cup, what we saw was that our entire mass media for something like 2 weeks leading up to the final just deluged us. You know, every single news and current affairs program, every single good morning kind of program, that they were just stuffed full of people that were going on and on and on and behaving like children on television about, you know, getting excited at Christmas coming. You know, it was that kind of an atmosphere that was being generated by the news media. And if you really wanted to maximize the disappointment that the public would experience, then the way to do that is to have this 2 week build up where you just going into raptures about the prospects of Britain winning and how wonderful it would be. And if you wanted to maximize the possibility that in that disappointment, if we didn't manage to win, that there would be, amongst the criticisms that would be thrown back, there would be some racial criticisms that would be thrown back, then what you would do is during that 2 week build up period, you would lionize the black players that are part of the England squad, and you would have them on television and ask them questions about how they've had to face racial discrimination in their lives, and have them tell the public over and over again about how they've had to overcome racial discrimination in their lives. And you would focus on the fact that the England players were taking the knee taking the knee is put forward as if it's some completely innocent action for which there can be no criticism whatsoever. But taking the knee is a public assertion that black people face unfair discrimination in white societies. And so it is a group libel of the white people who created those societies. It is, in fact, taking the knee, in my view, is an incitement to racial hatred. It is an incitement other black people and woke white people to hate white people because of the alleged discrimination that apparently these people are suffering. And yet what we've got with the footballers is that a considerable number of black footballers have been chosen to represent various teams in the in the Premier League and the other leagues, and also to participate in the England team as England players. And these people are paid phenomenal salaries. You know, so they're paid salaries like £20,000 a week. And the point is that if somebody said to you, I'll pay you £20,000 a week, and all you've got to do in order to get that £20,000 is do something that you're really good at naturally anyway, which is kicking a ball about, and we'd like you to spend some time each day practicing, but we'd like you once a week to spend an hour and a half kicking a ball about on a field with 21 other people, and if you happen to do very well at this, then you'll get lots of people making positive comments about you on the internet. But if you actually mess it up one day and don't actually perform as well as you thought you were going to, then you're probably going to get some abuse where people are going to call you some rude names. And some of those rude names are going to be racially motivated rude names. Do you want that job? Now, if you turn around to the hundreds of thousands of people that are unemployed at the moment, the hundreds of thousands of people that are working on 0 hours contracts or the minimum wage, if you said to them, we'll pay you £20,000 a week, and all you've got to do is to be prepared to do something you're good at, and if you mess it up one week, then you'll get some abuse, and some of that abuse will be racial abuse, do you think you can handle that? I think the majority of those people that you pose that question to would say, yes, I can handle that, and they'd bite your arm off for the chance of getting that £20,000 a week. And so what we're talking about here isn't downtrodden people who have led miserable lives as a result of the discrimination that they faced. What we've got are privileged and pampered prima donnas who expect to be able to go down on the knee in front of the British people and therefore libel the British people in the way that I've said. It is an incitement to racial hatred to take the knee publicly. Taking the knee is the equivalent of the white players giving a Nazi salute. That's how offensive that is to the British people. And yet we're prepared to, we're supposed to just suck it up. Well, sorry, you know, if you try to create a situation where there is this unrealistic expectation that we're going to win and you spend 2 weeks first of all, promoting all of the non-white players within the England team to a great extent, and you allow them to take the knee in front of the British public, and they then cock up at the end when it comes to actually taking the penalties, then it's really human nature, isn't it? That out of all the criticism that you're going to get, there's going to be a small amount of it which is going to be racial. And as I said, I don't support that. So let's get that out of the way, first of all. But there's going to be some criticism. And if they get criticism, then the players ought to accept the criticism. They shouldn't try to portray all the criticism they get as racial criticism. They should accept that some of the criticism that they received as a result of messing up was quite legitimate.
You know, they're quite happy to get the adulation, aren't they? You know, you got to weigh it up. If you do well, they get masses of adulation and praise. And if they don't do well, they get criticism. And I think a lot of it is, and I was told this by somebody that watches the football, he says, when you're watching the football and somebody doesn't do well, you know, you shout out at them, and you shout out the first thing that you see. You know, it might be somebody who's fat, you know, you fat so-and-so. The first thing you see when somebody is black is the fact that they're black. So you say, you black so-and-so. It's not that they're actually thinking that what they're doing is racist. They're just pointing out that, it's that player over there, the one that's black. He's the one that made the mistake. It's not intended to incite hatred. It's criticism. And it's the first thing that strikes you about somebody, the most defining feature. It's not intended to really hurt the person in any way. It's just to single them out. That's the player that I'm talking about there. It's the one that's black. And yet the way that our laws are, if you use the word black before using a pejorative, that then it becomes racist. And I don't think a lot of these football fans actually think about that. And to get on to that taking the knee thing about it being a libel, it's also offensive against the national anthem. The whole point of it was that Colin Kaepernick refused to stand for the national anthem in America. So what they're saying is, by getting down on one knee, they're saying, we're refusing to stand for our national anthem. We're not patriotic. We hate our country. We don't want to stand for the national anthem. And that's why we're getting down on one knee. That's the reason for it. That is the symbolism of it. Priti Patel spoke out against this, and she said that people have a right to criticize it. It's not that they're saying that they're racist or anything like that. They're saying that they don't support Black Lives Matter, because Black Lives Matter is anti-family, it's anti-police, it's anti-white. And she got loads of criticism for this, and there were racist caricatures of her in The Guardian and in other newspapers, and of course they haven't been charged with hate crimes. She got a torrent of abuse for speaking up about this and saying people have a right to boo the team if they're going to take this political gesture, because it is political, and football is not supposed to allow politics into it in any way. I still don't understand how they can be allowed to do that. It's such an ostentatious gesture for them to do, to all get down on one knee. They look so ridiculous, especially when there are other teams that aren't doing it, and they're sort of trying to shame the other team with their virtue signalling. I mean, it's just disgusting to see. It's really sort of shamed football to see this politics that's got into it. And a lot of the football fans, that's the way that they see it. A lot of them are anti-racist, and they approve of this kick racism out of football thing and all the rest of it. But they don't approve of Black Lives Matter, because Black Lives Matter want to tear down our statues. They want to deface the statue of Winston Churchill. They want to deface the statue of Queen Victoria. They pull down the statues in America. That's what they are associated with. They are associated with hating Western civilization. And there you have a football team that is supposed to be representing the country, that is refusing to stand for the national anthem and showing allegiance to an organization that wants to tear down civilization. It's just absolutely ludicrous. And you know, when we say they're anti-racist, it's political, people will say, well it's not political because everybody should be against racism. Well, there are different ways of being against racism, aren't there? We're told, as you pointed out earlier, Max, that race matters, and that we shouldn't be colorblind. We should be seeing that people are black, and we should be making exceptions for them, and that we should be having more black police in black areas. We should be having more black teachers in black schools. Well, I agree with all of that. I think that we should go one step further, and we should separate the races. We should have areas for the blacks, and we should have areas for white people. And then you could have no more racism. Racism just would not exist at all. It would be impossible to happen. There could be no discrimination. Is there racial discrimination? Is there racism in Botswana? Is there racism in Bangalore? Is there racism in Japan? Well, no, there isn't, because they're all ethnically homogenous. Racism cannot exist in a racially homogenous territory. And that's the anti-racism that I support. And I dare say, probably some of these football fans, that they would suggest that was a good idea as well. But we're told that if you're anti-racist, you can only be anti-racist in Black Lives Matter's way of doing it, which is a left-wing way of doing it, which is taking from the whites to give to the blacks and forcing whites to become second-class citizens. And that is no good. That's no good for the country. I would consider myself to be anti-racist. I say what we do here is anti-racist, because that is the only way that you can get rid of racism. If you look at what we've done over the last 70 years, we've put all these laws in place, we've got diversity quotas, we've done everything we possibly can. And yet when you look at polls, they continually say, well, racism is getting worse. And it's not getting worse. I mean, if you look at the television programs from the 70s, there was a lot of racial humor that was used in the television programs, and you don't get that anymore. But the polls all still say that racism is getting worse. They all say anti-Semitism is getting worse. So it doesn't matter what you do in the way of appeasing these people, they will always say that racism is a problem. As you pointed out, Max, you've got very, very well paid people at the top of society that are then claiming that they're oppressed and that they've somehow been discriminated against, even though they were given the chance to take these penalties. So they're not discriminated against, yet they're still going to claim that. So this just shows that this left-wing way of dealing with racism, it doesn't work. It hasn't succeeded. We've had 70 years of it. It hasn't succeeded. They're still claiming that they are oppressed. They would not be able to do that if the races were separate. There were just racism would not be able to exist at all. And I think this is something that we should, you know, we should be promoting. We should be saying we are anti-racist, and our solution to the to racial discrimination is just to separate the races, and then racism cannot exist. Who is going to argue with that? There are black groups that promote black interests that are calling for the same thing. There's the NFF coalition in America that are pushing for this. There is Sasha Johnson's group, her Black Lives Matter group. I forget what the name of the party was. Sasha Johnson, who unfortunately she got shot, she was promoting this idea as well, that black people should have their separate black areas and they should have black schools and all the rest of it. And, you know, that is the only solution if you truly want to get rid of racism. But then you come to the question of, is that really what they're trying to do, or are they really just anti-white, and are they really just trying to come up with ways that they can hammer white people? Because that's the way that it seems to me, and I'm not saying that it's black people that think this up, of course, because the majority of them are white. It's white people doing it to white people. We have this pathological altruism where our charity goes outwards to these other groups, and we actually help them in competing against our own group, and that's where the actual failure is. It's within whites. It's white people who are not seeing ourselves as a group and who are not advocating for our own best interests. And these other groups, we can't expect them to start advocating for white people's interests, because that's completely unnatural. Just because we are doing what is unnatural, we can't expect these other groups to do what is unnatural. It is with white people where the fault is. But I think one way that we can counter this is to push this idea of get rid of racism, you would just separate the races. So all of this anti-racist stuff, it obviously has another goal behind it, which is being anti-white, don't you think, Max?
Yeah, I think absolutely. It's the anti-racism that's promoted by the left is an excuse that's used by the extreme left who want to use immigrant communities in this country as kind of cannon fodder in order to bring about a communist revolution, and so they are making the non-white communities feel that they're oppressed and that they are discriminated against, and that they must rise up against the white society that's doing this to them. And that is just the means that's used by the extreme left in order to bring about the revolution that they want, and to, as I say, use the non-white communities as cannon fodder.
They're just being manipulated, aren't they? They're being manipulated to try and weaken the bonds within society. We're not allowed to have groups based on ethnicity. Our churches have to be multicultural. We don't have the right to freedom of association, all these ways of actually weakening us from forming groups based on advocating for our interests. The people on the left will do that to us because they want to weaken society, because they want to bring in their own system of running society, which is like a mix of communism and capitalism, where everybody is just a number and is stripped of identity. Because if you have an identity that you can form groups around, then you've got bonds there that are so strong that people are willing to lay down their lives for them. And that's why we, you know, people were willing to lay down their lives for Britain in World War One and World War Two. It was a sense of ethnic solidarity, and they don't want anybody to rise up and change the system and get the system actually working to the benefit of white people. They want it to be working for the benefit of the banksters, and they will use anybody to do that, whether it's homosexuals, whether it's transsexuals, whether it's blacks, whether it's Muslims. The one thing that links all of them is that they're being used for anti-white purposes. Well, we've also got some other news this week. We are supposedly finally lifting the lockdown, but are we? Because it seems to me as if what they've really done is privatized the lockdown, because you're still going to have Wales that's going to be doing it. Scotland is still going to be making people wear masks. London Transport Authority is still going to be making people wear masks. Supermarkets are still going to be making people wear masks. So the government are saying, well, you don't really have to do this anymore. We're lifting the lockdown. But then you've got all these private companies which are going to insist on doing the same. And then we've also got this scandal, the Pingdemic scandal, which is the track and trace app, which is apparently pinging people and telling them that they've got to stay at home for 10 days because somebody in the next flat might have got COVID. So you've got all these false positives, and they think that the economy could crash, although it seems to me as if it has already crashed with this lockdown, just due to people no longer actually being able to go into work because of this COVID app. So I'm not quite sure what is going to happen on the 19th. It's actually today, isn't it, when we're supposedly having this great day of freedom. But it really doesn't look like it's going to turn out quite how we were expecting it to. Max, what are your thoughts on the great unlocking?
Well, the unlocking looks as if there's a bit of a cloud hanging over it at the moment, which is the fact that the Delta variant, the Indian variant of COVID, it has now expanded to the point where I think something like 100% of the current COVID cases are of the Indian variant in this country. And the Indian variant, is alternately described in some sources as being something which can be protected against by having the double vaccination. But other sources are saying, no, even if you have the double vaccination, it doesn't protect you, because something like 50% of the current cases are people who've been double vaccinated. And what it looks as though is that the thing that I kind of predicted around a year ago, which is that if we rely entirely on vaccines, then what will happen is that the vaccines will act as an evolutionary pressure on the virus, which will disproportionately bear down upon the less contagious and less virulent strains of the virus and get rid of those, but that in their place will evolve more virulent strains, which will be the only strains of the virus that survive. And so what we're having is now a series that have been now of more increasingly virulent strains of the virus. And now we've got the Indian variant, which is now causing infections and hospitalizations to increase. And I think inevitably, if the hospitalizations continue to increase, then we will start to see deaths increasing as well. And so it may just be that we've gone through this horror of the last kind of 15 months or so of lockdown, only to find that we're facing the coronavirus head on with very little in the way of defense. And we've gone through those 15 months almost for nothing. If a vaccine is going to work, then the vaccine, firstly, has got to be able to tackle not just one variant of the disease, but at least a very large number of the different of the variants. And that the vaccine has got to be made available very widely immediately, so that there isn't the time for the more virulent strains of the virus to mutate and to evolve some protection against the vaccine before the whole lot is wiped out. And the other thing as well is that While we are trying to combat the viruses, we also need to restrict travel. You know, a lot of people have complained, and a lot of the media have been quite rightly voicing complaints by people where they've had this kind of on-off situation with regard to summer holidays. But it should have been announced right at the beginning of the year that summer holiday travel, really, until we've got rid of the virus entirely, needs to be temporarily avoided. But more importantly than holidays as well, or just as importantly as holidays, we need to restrict international travel per se. And so we need to stop people from being able to migrate in an uncontrolled way across the world, because those migrating people will bring with them the strains from the other parts of the world, and the more virulent strains that have evolved in those other parts of the world. And so we need to, first of all, have a virus, as I say, which is a broad spectrum virus, not a narrow spectrum virus, so that it attacks all the known variants of the virus. It needs to be dispensed quickly so that there's maximum protection with a maximum number of people as soon as possible, and we need to restrict international travel at the same time in order to eradicate the virus before it has time to evolve.
I think another issue is that if you've actually caught the virus, then you're immune to it, and you're still going to be producing antibodies. Apparently, with these coronaviruses, 12 years later, you're still going to be producing antibodies. But the people that have been inoculated with the vaccine, the only thing that they're immune to is the spike protein. So they're still vulnerable to coronavirus, and that's why people are still getting it. Daniela Westbrook, she was double vaccinated, and she's in hospital with coronavirus at the moment. Very upset, because they've been saying, well, the reason why half the people with coronavirus in hospital have been vaccinated is because they're the elderly. They were the ones that were first vaccinated in the first place, and they're the ones that are more likely to catch it. But Daniela Westbrook, I think she's only about 40, 45, something like that, and she's in hospital with it. And we still don't know what the long-term effects of these so-called vaccines are going to be. And it does look as if, you know, they really haven't helped that much. It still is the fact that it's only really the elderly and those that have pre-existing medical conditions that are at risk from this virus. In actual fact, you're better off going through it and building up immunity to it than taking the vaccine, I would suggest. But yeah, we will just have to see what happens there, see where we are in a couple of weeks' time, I think, rather than going into that some more. So shall we get into our greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk some more about Robert Blatchford, the social nationalist, the British social nationalist. And we'll be quoting again from Merry England, his book. Last week we talked about British agriculture, and this week we will be looking at autarky. And again, we will be quoting from Blatchford's book, Merry England. So from page 34, he says, "Now, suppose we get at last to a state of things under which 36 million live on foreign-grown wheat and none on wheat of home growth. Suppose our agriculture is dead and we depend entirely upon foreigners for our daily bread. What will be our position then? Our position will be this. We shall be unable to produce our own food and can only get it by selling to foreign countries our manufactured goods. We must buy wheat from America with cotton goods. But first of all, we must buy raw cotton with which to make those goods. We are therefore entirely dependent upon foreigners for our existence. Very well, suppose we go to war with America. What happens? Do you remember the cotton famine? That was bad, but a mere trifle to what an Anglo-American war would be. We should, in fact, be beaten without firing a shot. America need only close her ports to corn and cotton, and we should be starved into surrender and acceptance of her terms. Or suppose a European war, say, with France or Russia. All our goods and all our food have to be brought overseas. What would it cost us to keep command of the seas? What would the effect of the panic be here? And suppose we found our communications cut. We should be starved into surrender at once. Or suppose France at war with America. Our sufferings would be something terrible. Don't you see that if we destroy our agriculture, we destroy our independence at a blow and become a defenseless nation? Now, I find this interesting because obviously we have our special relationship with America now. I very much doubt whether we would ever go to war with America. But back then, 100 years ago, we didn't actually have that relationship. And there was a fear that we could end up going to war with America. I don't think we could end up going to war with France, but there is concern about going to war with Russia. And still, a lot of our food comes from abroad. We're still not actually producing it for ourselves. And back then, we were still making cotton goods. I mean, today, we're mainly involved in financial instruments, or at least that's what they tell us, is that the City of London is essential for global trade because of the financial instruments. But I really can't think of much that we actually make in Britain now that we export to the rest of the world. And really, we should be making the very best of whatever it is that we need within the country, and certainly growing our own food for ourselves. What do you make of what he has to say here, Max?
Well, I think this is something that we went into last week in some detail, really, which and I think the same can be said of the last few remarks that you've read out about him, that you know, he's absolutely correct. Autarky, which is having self-sufficiency in terms of all vital goods and services, autarky is something that every nation should strive for, because it gives that nation its independence. If you are dependent upon the other nations around you, then you don't have independence, you have interdependence. And interdependence means that you can't act independently, you can't act individually, you've got to always move with the group. For any nation to function properly as an independent nation, you need to have autarky. As I think I said last time we discussed this, the Blatchford went to sort of great lengths to demonstrate that it would be possible for England to feed herself, I think is the way he described it there. I think it probably was more a matter of Britain and the British Isles in those days, because Southern Ireland would have still been part of the British Isles and part of Britain up to that point. But it was possible for, you know, he'd calculated together with an aristocrat that the British Isles could support 200 million people. And I think that, you know, as I said last time as well, I've checked those figures out using just purely potatoes. And obviously nobody wants to eat a diet of just purely potatoes. But if we just ate potatoes, then we could produce enough potatoes, even in Britain in its diminished size, having lost Southern Ireland, we could still produce enough potatoes to feed the entire nation. So the possibility of autarky still presents itself, and if we were to pursue a policy of autarky, it would put us in such a so much stronger position, because all of the issues that we have with the European Union at the moment about trade between our crossing our borders, all of those issues would be massively diminished in their severity and their importance if we were able to feed ourselves, and if we were able to produce enough white goods to service our the domestic demand, if we're able to produce enough cars to service domestic demand for cars, etc. So autarky in all things is a good thing, and Blatchford was absolutely right.
It has produced a great boost to the economy in Russia and in China, where there's been sanctions against them. They've had to produce all their own goods. But what do you have to say about the argument that interdependence prevents wars between the countries that are interdependent? Because this is the argument that was used for forming the EU, is that if we have everybody joined up, and if the trade is all joined up and everybody is relying on everybody else, then there won't be any wars. And you have to admit, there hasn't been any wars since the war against Germany, apart from this war against Serbia, but Serbia was outside of the EU. So what would you say to that argument, Max, that the interdependence does actually prevent wars?
The interdependence will, to some extent, prevent wars from being able to be waged as easily. I don't know that it would necessarily stop wars altogether. I think that I'm just trying to think back at the struggles that there have been within the European Union. You've only got to look, I suppose, at the situation in Northern Ireland, the troubles that existed there. Struggle against the IRA, in my view, was a low-level war. It wasn't actually just criminality on the part of various criminal individuals. It was a war between those people in Northern Ireland who wanted a Republican, who wanted Northern Ireland to be absorbed into a free Ireland covering the entire island of Ireland. There was a war on that basis. I think it's fairly logical that if you have interdependence, it is going to create some barriers to wars, but it also creates barriers to towards any or all sorts of other things. And if you have a situation where because the interdependence means also that you've got to have regulations imposed on all of the groups that are imposed by the majority upon the entire population of an entity like the European Union. As soon as there is sufficient polarization for one group, one way or the other, to be prepared to use force, then a war would occur. And the war would either be a war where the European Union used its might and the fact that it is developing, intends to develop a European army, uses that European army to crush a rebellion in a rebellious part of the European Union, or a war in the sense that the people within that rebellious part of the European Union take a leaf out of the IRA's book decide to fight a guerrilla war against the empire.
Yeah, so there is some argument for interdependence, but you would still be at risk anyway. I mean, it's really a fool's argument, isn't it, to just not produce all your own goods because you can get it from these other groups, and then there'll be less chance of war, because it just puts you at risk of then being taken over by the banks, really, by the majority, as you pointed out there, with the European Union, and the majority ended up making laws for the minority, and you really not having much say about it. I mean, it's a way to stealthily take over a country, isn't it, to get them to be all interdependent with these other countries. Well, continuing,
it builds up resentment on the part of the minority that are having the views of the majority imposed upon them and to their detriment, as they would see it.
Yeah, I think that's what we see happening in Hungary, isn't it? Hungary yes. is not happy about that. Well, continuing from page 35, don't you see that the people who depend on foreigners for their food are at the mercy of any ambitious statesman who chooses to make war upon them? And don't you think that it is a rather stiff price to pay to get a farthing off of the loaf? Well, Mr. Smith, thanks to the Manchester School, to the factory system, and to the grasping landlord, who is generally a Tory and fond of barging about the security of the empire, we are almost helpless now. Another 20 years of prosperous trade and cheap bread, and we are done for. Again, how shall we look if, after we have killed our agriculture, we lose our trade? Do you think that impossible? Your cotton lords seem to think it possible enough, and are now telling you that the only means of keeping the trade, which is to kill your agriculture, lose your national independence, and to lower your wages. That farthing off the loaf is going to cost you dear, John Smith, before you have done with it. And I think here he's pointing out that if you depend on these foreigners, you'll be at the mercy of any ambitious statesman. But really, we've been at the mercy of the ambitious bankers, which he hasn't really mentioned here. Does he mention the bankers at all in the book? Do you know, Max? And what are your thoughts on this?
He does mention bankers. I don't know that necessarily we should think too much in terms of bankers, more in terms of, as far as foreign trade is concerned, foreign trade eventually results in a race to the bottom in terms of wages, because if workers at home are having to compete with workers around the other side of the world who have a much lower standard of living and who are prepared to work for a fraction of what is needed in order to make a living in this country, then what will happen is that goods produced around the other side of the world will be imported because they'll be cheaper, and that will then put our homegrown industries out of business, or it will force our workers to work for the same wages that people are able to survive on around the other side of the world. And we see that happening to a certain extent with various globalist countries saying that there is a need, or politicians that support and are mouthpieces for globalist companies. We see them saying that it's necessary for us to become competitive with the rest of the world. And what that means is that we effectively have to find some magic way of making more with less, or we have to accept a lower standard of living. And so from that point of view, in terms of the welfare of the majority of people, it places that welfare at odds with the welfare of the globalist trader, because the globalist trader obviously is going to buy from the parts of the world that have got the lowest prices, the people that work there. And so, as I say, international trade therefore creates a race to the bottom. And that's why, as far as British industry is concerned, when we were a far more nationalist country, when we relied far more on homegrown produce, we built up an empire and we were a very powerful nation within the world. But once we stopped doing that, what's happened is that we've become economically weaker and weaker. Our industries have been exported abroad. We're importing more from abroad than we've ever done before. As far as the majority of people in this country are concerned, we haven't really had a real terms pay rise for probably 30 years. And so what we're seeing is a process whereby the living standard in this country has topped out and is slowly in decline because of competition from cheap labour abroad, or competition from cheap labour that is imported into this country or allowed to migrate into this country from abroad.
If you look at the countries that actually have autarky, if you look at China and you look at Russia, I mean, their economies are booming, their wages are going up, their life expectancy is going up, you know, that they're having a whale of a time. And they're attacked by the World Banks and by NATO and the rest of it for having nationalist policies, basically, particularly in China, where they invest in the private companies and they get told, well, this is unfair business practices. You're not supposed to help your own country out. Well, why not? And it's the same with Russia, where Russia has been put under all these sanctions. Russia ends up now producing all its own goods for itself. And again, their wages keep increasing, their quality of life keeps on increasing. I mean, it really does shame this Western capitalist system when you look at Russia and China and how well they are doing. And it is down to autarky. It's down to taking pride in the fact that you produce everything that you need for yourself. I mean, who is going to be best at doing that? Well, obviously, you are going to be best at doing that, and that is the way that we used to be, and that is what led to us having an empire, and it's losing that, and that has led to us losing the empire, basically. Continuing with these quotes here, he says, "Your trade unions tell you that you have beaten all foreign competition except that of India. Do you think that you can fight India, John? I don't, because in India labour is so cheap, and because your cotton lords, John, some of whom are liberals and friends of the people, John, and others of whom are Tories, who would die for the safety of the empire, John, who will take precious good care to use that cheap Indian labour to bring down your wages, John, by means of competition. Oh, John, John, you silly fellow, have you no eyes? These are some of the reasons why I don't love the factory system. Consider them and read the history of that system, and how its first successes were bought by the murder and torture of little children, and spent in buying the freedom of West Indian slaves, and in waging war against the French Republic. The thing is evil. It is evil in its origin, in its progress, in its methods, in its motives, and in its effects. No nation can be sound whose motive power is greed. No nation can be secure unless it is independent. No nation can be independent unless it is based upon agriculture. So I think it's great there that we see, you know, we see that the green agenda that is tied in with the nationalist agenda that is tied in with the socialist agenda. And yes. You're thinking he's a socialist, and yet he's pointing out at that time there that you know, we should have been concentrating on our own people, not buying the freedom of West Indian slaves. I mean, that's very interesting for me to see that somebody who is a socialist is pointing that out, that, you know, that we should have been looking at what was going on here. And do you know who he's talking about here with the murder and torture of little children? And why did he think it was wrong to wage war against the French Republic? Do you know?
I can't really think off the top of my head about the last question about the French Republic. A lot of the taxes that were a lot of taxes were raised so that the government could buy out the right of again globalist traders and people who owned plantations in the Americas to buy out their right to own slaves, which is something that, you know, Black Lives Matter have been complaining about. But, you know, basically what's happened in the intervening period is that the British taxpayer has paid for the money that was given to those slave owners. And so, you know, we've actually done our bit as far as providing those people with their freedom. The murder and torture of little children basically just refers to, I think, the iniquitous working conditions that existed in factories. And I think last time I sort of described the way in which the factory machinery didn't have safety guards and things of that sort fitted in those days. And so little children were very often required to crawl around under machines, lubricating them. And in the case of the textiles industry, where the weft of the cotton, or whatever it's called, the strand of cotton where it snapped, or wool where it snapped, then had to be joined back together again. Very often children would have been employed to tie the knots in those pieces of string while the machinery was still operating. And so they had these very fast moving parts to these machines, and quite often little children would lose a finger or two in doing that kind of work. And so it was very long hours that they had to work for very little pay, and it was very dangerous for them to work under those conditions, not just because of the fear of being injured, but also from the fact that the atmosphere in those textile mills would have been laden with cotton dust and with particles of cut strands of wool, etc., which would have been inhaled into their lungs. And I think a lot of people developed lung diseases as a result of working under those conditions.
Well, he's also can see far ahead here to what was going to happen with India. I mean, we looked at India and we thought, well, this is good, there'll be a trading partner, they will buy the things that we can make within Britain. But he could see that in India labor is so much cheaper, and eventually all that we're producing here in Britain, is all the machinery is going to be shipped off over to India, and they'll be making it in India because they'll be able to do that cheaper. And he's pointing out that there's no loyalty here to the people, from the cotton lords, from the Tories to the Liberals. None of them have actually got any loyalty to the British people. They're just thinking about where they can get the labour the cheapest, and obviously it's going to be from India, and that is what happened. So he could see that's what was going on. And I mean, he wrote this book around about 1900, and it didn't happen for quite some time after that, but eventually it did. I mean, he was so right in what he was pointing out here, and it's such a shame that today the green agenda has been hijacked by the communists and the, you know, the socialist ideas, which are basically just nationalist ideas. They've been hijacked by the communists, and the nationalists don't often talk about these things so much, because, I mean, when you think about it, the green agenda, it's blood and soil, isn't it? It's all about the soil. We were the ones that were first concerned about the damage that was being done to our country. If you look at Patriotic Alternative today, most of what they do is out in the countryside, getting people out in the countryside, going on hikes, litter picking, appreciating the beauty of the country that we live in. It's not just all about race, it's about the land that we live in and the way that it's been shaped by our forefathers. And the only people that are truly going to appreciate that are the children of our forefathers, the children of the people that that shape the land that are going to continue to shape it. And yet this has now been hijacked, and you have the Green Party, which is basically just a front for communism. Do you know whether the left actually look to Blatchford as a hero of the left, or do they sort of try to forget about him and his nationalist leanings, Max? Do you know anything about that?
I think they try to forget about him, to be quite honest. And what Blatchford predicted with regard to India not only happened with India, but it's also since World War II happened with Japan as well. You see, Japan was a country that had been developing machinery, etc., and going through an industrial revolution, which is what then enabled the Japanese to wage war. But the point is that at the end of the Second World War, if you compared Japan to Germany, Germany had been absolutely bombed flat, so their industry was temporarily out of action. Whereas, as far as Japan is concerned, they'd had two nuclear weapons drops on them, but all the rest of their society, all the rest of their country was still intact. And yet it was then taken over by primarily by the Americans, but notionally by the Allies. But it then created a massive market where the country was going through a kind of a political revolution. And it made it easy then for multinational firms from America to move into Japan and to take advantage of the fact that they'd got a skilled workforce, the fact that they had industrialized, and they then started to produce cars and motorcycles much more cheaply than they could be produced in America. And so therefore, if you look at Detroit and the large car manufacturing plants and things that existed in that belt of America, together with Harley Davidson, who were producing very large numbers of motorcycles, what's then happened was that they were competing against Japanese workers who, because they'd lost the war and who therefore had very much diminished circumstances, were prepared to work for much lower wages than the American workers had become used to working for. And but because they were skilled people who had industrialized, they were very quickly able to create a mass market for Japanese produced motorcycles, initially in the United States and also in Europe, but also then a mass market for Japanese produced cars. And now we see that Detroit is at just a shadow of its former self, and large swathes of the American car industry have just been wiped out by Japan. And then once the Japanese had increased their standard of living, so that they their standard of living has risen now to rival the standard of living in countries in the West. So we've then had China following suit, and China being the provider of cheap labor, who have then taken a lot of work away from Japan. And if you go online and you look at very cheaply produced cars, and particularly at the moment very cheaply produced motorcycles and other electrical goods, iPhones and things of that sort, the Chinese are the ones that are making them, because the Chinese have started off from a much lower level where wages were much lower. So they've just purely on the basis of wages, they've been able to undercut the industries that had previously existed in America and in Europe, but then transferred to Japan. And so the Chinese have undercut the Japanese. And now we've got the little tiger republics of Southeast Asia also now then producing goods in an attempt to undercut the Chinese. And so it's this continual process of undercutting that is the consequence of global capitalism, and which creates a kind of moving feast of a moving famine of political and economic uncertainty that just rolls around the world as one country faces economic deprivation as a result of being undercut by another, and then in turn undercuts another part of the world, and so on. So it is a sad situation and a sad system that needs to be replaced.
It strikes me that one thing that covers this up, because people think, well, we're getting cheaper and cheaper goods. Look how cheap the goods are that's coming from China. So okay, things might go down a little bit in price, but what about inflation? You know, we've had masses of inflation all the while that things get cheaper. They might seem to be a little bit cheaper to buy, but everything gradually goes up, doesn't it? Because we always have inflation all the time. If you look at the prices that things used to be in the 60s, I mean, they're 10 times the price now. But if you were to go back 150 years, you would find that the prices were stable for going back hundreds of years before that. They were the same price. If you look at ancient history, everything was the same price right throughout the ancient civilizations of the Near East. And then you come to the 20th century, and suddenly, after the Second World War, you get this inflation all the time that's happening. So it's an illusion. You've got an illusion that things are actually getting cheaper while they're being you're able to make them cheaper abroad. But everything gradually goes up in price. I'm correct in thinking that, aren't I, Max?
Yes, everything does go up in price as a result of that, because within the countries where they start off with a very low standard of living, and so therefore are able to undercut their competitors on the basis of their low wages, then as a result of undercutting their competitors, they then gradually become wealthier themselves, and therefore they then start to pay themselves more money, and they then fall victim to the same thing themselves. But the thing really which is driving inflation, firstly, there's some inflation which is caused as a result of manipulations within the banking system within the world. But also inflation is being caused by virtue of the fact that we have unrestricted and unrestrained population growth across the world. And that is then feeding demand for the limited resources that exist across the globe, and that is driving prices up.
So you might get cheaper electronic gadgets from China, but the actual value of the money that you have in your hand, it's continually losing its value while you've got this illusion of these cheap gadgets. Well, that finishes the quotes from the book Merry England, and I think we will continue next week looking at Blatchford's life after the war. So thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back in 2 weeks with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.